What does Mona Lisa actually mean?
What does an artist do with a donkey?
And who is the Dada in Dadaism?
Learn why canvases are named after drugs, what's bizarre about Baroque, and which artistic movements have insulting names on this fine art-themed episode of Words Unraveled.
Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words.
And I'm Jess Safaris, author of etymology books, including Useless Etymology. And today we're getting artsy-fartsy on Words Unraveled.
Yeah, certainly arty. Hopefully not too farty, but who knows what'll happen. We're here for a long time. Jess.
Yes.
We're talking about art. We're talking about methods. We're talking about artists. We're talking about
supplies.
Schools. Supplies. Talking about all of that, but we need to start with the word art itself. Just three little letters. Where does it come from?
Yeah, it's meant art for a long time. The old French word was basically art. The Latin word was basically artem or ars. We also see that. We see ars in the names of many treatises on a variety of topics, including sciences and such, because art was also a word for practical skills or businesses or crafts. And it's originally from a root meaning to fit together, the ideas of assembling things, artisanal type activities. And funny enough, it's related to the Latin word arma, meaning weapons, for a similar reason.
Oh,
because
okay.
One must have skill to use them.
Something I find interesting is, so the art at the start of artificial is from art, right? It's the idea of creation of something. But I also find quite interesting is here in Germany, the word for artificial is kunstlich and the word for art is kunst. So you've had exactly the same journey from the word for art to the word of artifice. And therefore, artificial intelligence in German is called künstliche Intelligenz, which I think is kind of cool. That
artificial wasn't a bad thing originally. We kind of have a negative connotation or a pejorative connotation on it. But artificium in Latin, for example, was a word for a work of art or a skill or a theory or a system.
Yeah, an artifice is something created. Well, created.
Yeah, exactly.
It can just stop the sentence there. Yeah, something that has been fashioned with skill. Great. Where do we go with art? I mean, we can break. We're basically talking about painting types of art here, aren't we? Maybe a bit of modern art, a bit of architecture thrown in there. Should we start with some schools of art?
We could do that, certainly. This is our blank canvas.
Oh no! But you got to start there. Then you got to start with canvas.
Well, you can start with canvas then.
Yeah. Of course we have, because it's one of the more surprising etymologies, I'd say.
It absolutely is. It entered English in the 14th century. A lot of these came from French. You will find that French is the source of many of these words, though you have another language family that you'll talk about as well. Mm. Put a pin in that. But the word canvas literally means made of hemp, because it was made of hemp or flax, which means it's related to which word?
Cannabis! Yeah, it just means a cloth, right? It's a cloth.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
a cloth made of hemp, which is what a canvas is, you know.
There was also a type of canvas called cotton duck, like the quack quack duck, or duck canvas, which was tightly woven, a particularly tightly woven type of canvas. And the word duck comes from, it's a Dutch word. Oh yeah, there's that other language family. But again,
yes,
we'll get to more
already.
But the predecessor to duct tape was a non-adhesive strip of cotton duck cloth that was called duct tape after the same word. And then the name was transferred to this plastic-coated adhesive tape in World War II. And now Duck is a brand of duct tape.
You have this chain of command, which goes from duct tape back then to duct tape, and then apparently back to duck tape. Although,
yes.
Actually, I don't think the duct tape thing necessarily has to be in there, because it does just get called duct tape by a lot of people.
Yes.
As well as duct tape. So actually, calling it duct tape ever is kind of a folk etymology. It should never have been called duct tape at all. So when people say, actually, it's duct tape, not duct tape, they are not more correct than those.
No, it's true.
It's duct tape. There's an understanding of why that is, because you might use it to tape up a duct, presumably.
Yeah, presume.
On canvas, though, you can canvas politically So you can canvas opinion. And these are the same, this is the same word.
You can cannabis opinion.
Yes, you're basically cannabising opinion. Yeah, you are hemping opinion. Well, actually the idea is that it invokes is the idea of gathering things in a sort of cloth, sort of a cloth bag. So gathering opinions in a cloth bag, you know.
Oh, that's awesome.
Shaking them up. But the difference is that that form of canvassing, political canvas, has two S's at the end. But it is the same word. It's just we've chosen that the way we're going to differentiate between political canvassing and a canvas upon which you write is or paint is that we're going to spell that one with two S's.
Before canvas was a more popular medium for painters, most people were painting on pieces of wood that were coated with lots of layers of gesso. And gesso is also coated, used on canvas as well. But you know why in
gesso.
Particular?
Gesso sounds like a cleaning product that you've invented.
It does. We can talk about that one in a second. It is not okay. A brand name. But do you know why we started using canvas, why it became so popular?
No.
Because there was a lot of canvas in Venice. And that's okay. Where a lot of the artists live. Lived.
Yeah. Venetians are going to come up a lot in this. Because an interesting thing about El Greco, the Greek, actually, of a Venetian, really, grew up in Crete, which was part of the Venetian Empire at the time, did a lot of his work in Italy and Spain. I suppose it makes sense that you'll be referred to as the foreigner if you were always working somewhere else, but actually not an awful lot of time spent in Greece, but, you know, signing things with Greek script. So that's probably why.
I said I could explain gesso,
yeah,
which
on.
Is just very briefly. It is a white preparatory coating. It's an Italian word that we just borrowed, but it means chalk or plaster. And it comes from the Latin word gypsum, also meaning plaster, from the Greek, I think, gypsos, meaning chalk or plaster. So this isn't that big of a mystery. But traditional gesso was used starting in the 13th century, and it was originally made of animal glue, usually rabbit skin, combined with chalk or gypsum and a white pigment, or it's like a glue made of rabbit skin, but then it's brushed in lots of layers and then sanded smooth. And it was originally hard and brittle, so it worked really well on medieval panels, which don't bend like canvas. And then it was updated in its composition for painting on canvas.
Yeah, because you do see on antique shows, they've got this sort of wooden style of, well, it's not, you call it a canvas, but it is not canvas, right?
Right.
You can't call it a canvas. I mean, you sort of can, obviously, but if you do so, you're doing it figuratively. And you would put your canvas on an easel, which is a name with a very surprising origin, because it's from the Dutch for donkey. So an easel with a canvas upon it is a donkey carrying marijuana, effectively.
Oh, man, that's amazing.
Yeah, the Dutch ezel is donkey. Much like, you know, I dry my clothes on a clothes horse. So donkey is just a thing that carries a thing. It's not too difficult. But we've alluded already to the fact that we get a lot of Dutch words for art in the English language, including words like easel, including sketch, which is basically just a Dutch word. It's quite an interesting sort of chain that you can follow with the word sketch. So you've got skets in Dutch, which comes from schizzo, which is Italian. That in turn is supposed to come from an unattested Latin word, which is schedius, which means a raft. Right, but that's not really what we're getting at. What we're getting at is the Greek skedios, which means something that is temporary or made offhand. So that is where we get idea of a sketch, being a schizo. You know, it's something that is rough, offhand, and temporary. And then, yeah, the Dutch word means that, and then the English word means that as well. The words etch and sketch both come from Dutch. They're not related, but they do both come from Dutch, because an etch is from the Dutch etsen, which means to cause to be eaten.
Ooh,
it's really interesting.
Yeah.
So that would mean it is related to the word eat. So etch and eat are related. And it's because when you etch something, you eat, you basically eat away at the surface of whatever you're etching it into. That's kind of fun. But the one that I think is the most interesting Dutch word in English in terms of the artistic world is landscape, which I think we might have talked about before. It means landship, ship as in championship, relationship.
Friendship.
This suffix that we have, friendship, exactly. And land being, well, the land or more the sort of countryside, I think, is more of an implication of the Dutch word. And I've got a really entertaining book that was written in 1607 called The Art of Drawing with the Pen by a guy called Henry Peacham. And in it, he basically introduces us to the word landscape. And he spells it landskip, so L-A-N-D-T.
So you can see the ship better.
S-K-I-P. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can really see that it's a foreign word. And he actually says landskip is a Dutch word, and it is as much as we should say in English, landship, or expressing of the land by hills, woods, castles, seas, valleys, ruins, hanging rocks, cities, towns, etc. But what I find really interesting about this is the fact that you could, even without your camera, go to the top of a hill and admire the landscape and not be talking about art at all. You're not talking about a painting, but what you are doing is figuratively invoking the idea of a painting. You're not, so a landscape painting is not a painting of a landscape.
Right.
Necessarily. The landscape you see before you, you are figuratively referring to as a painting.
A painting, because that came first. Yeah. Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
So good.
You could, I can't remember the name for this, but you know where you have like a fragment of a word that you then sort of take off and then you apply it to other ones?
It's called rebracketing.
Is it still rebracketing even if it's like correctly bracketed? Because ship is the element.
Oh yeah, you know, you've got a point.
Because normally it's when you take it like the wrong chunk of a word, that isn't really.
Oh yeah, you're right. Mm-hmm.
But it might be, it genuinely might be a type of rebracketing. But seascape, for example, or hellscape is whatever that is called. It's the taking of that Dutch skip from the end of land skip and then applying it to other things. Because we don't take seascape literally from zeeskip, as it, I guess it would be in Dutch. Excuse my pronunciation. Anyway. But anyway, I think that's kind of cool. So it says the Dutch were incredibly influential, 17th century artists, the Dutch East India Company and other Dutch interests abroad are bringing back an awful lot of wealth. So you've got a growing middle class who could afford to buy art. And before that time, art is mainly being commissioned by churches and for religious reasons, but people want to decorate their houses with it. So you all of a sudden get this boom in the production of art, and the Dutch are leading the way, and they become really the sort of driving force of painting.
This is the 17th century, the Dutch golden age, right? With like Rembrandt and Vermeer.
Those are the big names. Rembrandt's got a funny name. We do well though. We call him Rembrandt by his first name because his surname is Van Rijn, as in of the River Rhine.
Which we do the opposite for many artists.
We do. Like if we call Da Vinci Da Vinci, which we're not supposed to do, we're supposed to call him Leonardo, but it just feels non-specific, doesn't it? You can't call someone of Vinci. You've got to say who they are of Vinci. But Rembrandt has another name that I'd never come across before. So his full name is Rembrandt Harmanszoon van Rijn. I've definitely pronounced that wrongly. Apologies. But it means son of Harman. It's a patronymic. So you can get patronymic Dutch names, which is, again, something I hadn't actually realized. When we call him Rembrandt, we just took calling him by his first name.
From the same century, but a little earlier, we have Caravaggio, whose first name is Michelangelo. That one was already taken.
Oh, while we're on names, Picasso, full name Pablo Ruiz Picasso. You know, this Spanish thing of taking two surnames, one from your father, one from your mother. So we could have been referring to him as Ruiz, his dad's name, but instead he decided to go by his mum's surname, more famously.
I think one of the reasons that people often are surprised to find that Picasso is a 20th century artist is because he is known mononymously like these older masters.
I mean, we do know him as Pablo Picasso. Yeah, people know his name is Pablo, don't they? It's like you do that. You just do that with artists anyway. Like we call Dali Dali. We know his name is Salvador. But
do we? Yeah, I guess we do. You're right.
It's just quicker to say it's a Van Gogh than it's a Vincent Van Gogh. That's me trying to say Van Gogh properly. Something like that. Gogh. But you can't call it, well, can you call him Van Gogh if that means he's from Gogh? We just need to call him a Vincent.
Vincent.
And I think maybe they do that in arty-farty world. Maybe they do just call him Vincent.
That's odd, because if you did that now, you could end up with someone who's just the artist Fred.
Jess, the artist. Be more specific.
Rob Arts. Instead of Rob Words.
Yeah, I've done some arts. Yeah, but that's my little Dutch segue, where I'm sure I've upset all kinds of Dutch people with my dreadful pronunciations. But my overall point is one of respect for the 17th century Dutch artists, because we're still using their words today.
Well, they were Baroque artists, and if it ain't Baroque, don't fix it.
Hey. Tell us about Baroque or Baroque.
So this is the style of architecture from 1600 to 1750. It's about drama and movement and grandeur and emotional intensity. And the French word means irregular or bizarre. And it's thought to be originally from a Portuguese word meaning an irregular pearl, and we'll get to a related word in just a minute, but it was originally used pejoratively by later critics. Like, Baroque period artists did not call themselves Baroque period artists. It was later used by critics who thought the style was overly complicated and bizarre and excessively ornate. The idea was that the church wanted emotionally powerful imagery that could inspire faith and awe, and so the style has a lot of contrast of light and shadow and ornamentation and dynamic movements and theatrical effects. Like Caravaggio, for example, was really big on dramatic lighting called tenebrism, I believe is how you pronounce it, but somebody might need to verify that, where the figures kind of emerge from a deep darkness or a very dark background. This is also called chiaroscuro, which is the artistic use of strong contrasts between dark and light that create volume and depth.
It's literally and light and literally dark, means, isn't it?
Yeah. The
word.
Light, dark, which is really cool. But the Greeks were already using that kind of thing as well.
Baroque is directly related to the word verruca.
What? Oh, that
makes
perfect sense.
They both go back to the
same
Latin root. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it does make perfect sense. You know how ba uh-huh. and va are basically the same? We learned this when we were learning about Spanish, right? How the Spanish pronounce ba and va the same. Well, you can trace Baroque back to a Latin word that began with a va and also gave us verruca as well. And it makes perfect sense. The idea of something sort of warty and lumpy and irregular. Voila.
That's fantastic.
But we should mention Rococo, though, shouldn't we? You can't mention Baroque without mentioning Rococo. I mean, Rococo is effectively a form of Baroque. It's like a late Baroque.
It is lighter and more playful than Baroque, and it's more decorative, and it was more for like inside your parlor. It means shell work or rock work. So we've got our pearls, our irregular pearls, and then our rock work. And the critics referred to Rococo as anything frivolous or excessively ornate. And it's I'd say the more emblematic context in which you see this is like during the reign of Louis the 15th, and then from then on, and it's all this like grandeur and drama and florals and romantic scenes and pastels and frolicking courtship.
And it's from this French word rocaille, right? And it's probably just sort of a fun repetition of the sort of the k sound that turns it into rococo. I mean, it seems like oh, that's a very European-y word, but it's quite hard to pin down where in Europe it's from. Well, that's because it's kind of concocted.
Since we're moving chronologically, we should talk about Impressionism next and then the movements that came out of it.
Yeah, so we mentioned how Impressionism was named after people who didn't like it. And it's true that it seems like the word Impressionist, which came about before Impressionism, appears to have been coined in a really nasty review of a load of Impressionist paintings, including a load of Monet paintings. And it's actually thought that Impressionism comes from the title of a specific Monet painting, which was Impression Soleil Levant, which means, you know, impression of the sunrise. And if you look at it, it's a very sort of murky image. But the point of Impressionism is that you are giving the impression of the image without like precisely drawing it. I don't know if I'm putting that across correctly, but you're using sort of big strokes and points and stuff rather than trying to accurately, you know, it's like doing a low res image of something, right? You get the impression of it. That's literally it. This is what they're saying when they say this is our impression of the sun rising. It's not And if you look at Monet's work and lots of artists, lots of impressionist artists, you'll see what I'm talking about. It's that they're not trying to paint every little detail. They're trying to represent what they see or what's in their heads.
A common feature of them is visible brush strokes and brighter colors and sort of everyday subjects that are created in a more for that era modern way.
The sort of coining comes in this review by a guy called Louis Leroy in 1874. I don't know for certain, I guess, if he's come up with this word, but he's used it to say, to indulge his insanity and out of fear of irritating him, I looked for what was tolerable among the impressionist pictures. And I acknowledged without too much difficulty that the bread, grapes and chair of Breakfast by Monsieur Monet were good bits of painting. So this is him at the end of a scathing review of all kinds of paintings. He's just gone, I don't like any of this. It's horrible. He just said, well, I didn't think the grapes were quite nice in that Monet one. But he refers to the people that did all these paintings that he doesn't like as impressionists.
All of the artistic movements, the progression of them always feels like the next generation being like, well, we're bored of this now. Let's try something else.
Yeah. But tell us about some of the movements that come out of impressionism.
So expressionism is a reaction to impressionism. The expressionists thought that impressionism was too concerned with external experiences, so they wanted to express inner experience instead. So they used these distorted forms and exaggerated colors. And instead of realistic perspective, they started leaning into psychological intensity and ecstasy and spiritual yearning and alienation. There's a good example. An early expressionist painting is The Scream. The movement is distorted and it makes you feel a certain way and expresses what the artist and the character in it is feeling. Then after World War II, we get this new generation of artists that push the emphasis on subjective emotional experience further to abstract expressionism. The term was popularized in like the 1940s, give or take. So in the aftermath of World War II, we get influences from earlier versions like abstraction, cubism, surrealism, which we'll get to in just a second, and expressionism. One of the more iconic artists associated with abstract expressionism would be Jackson Pollock, for example, the drip paintings and splatters and such, and then Rothko and things like this. It uses more abstract, which is, you know, the word that's in the name, to express spontaneous, uncensored actions that are intended to be as much about the process as the ultimate artwork at the end through bypassing conscious control of your creativity.
I learned some things there. Thanks,
Jess. Yes.
I never had any art history lessons. You've had one or two, right? But I'm completely ignorant with all of this. I mean, I basically had to learn all of this for the sake of this episode. I'm good on how the words work out, but the actual understanding of the philosophies behind it, it's all very new to me.
I am by no means an expert, but my sister is. She is a fine artist who has had works displayed in museums and in other places.
And on my T-shirt, by the way.
And on
available
your T-shirt.
In our store, the Star Sailor. Sorry, it's sweaty. We've had 41 degrees Celsius here in Berlin.
Oh. That's awful.
Hot stuff over here in Berlin. But it's handling the sweat very well. Highly recommend one of Jess's sister's designs. Oh, can I talk about Dadaism? Let's talk about Dadaism.
Yes, let's talk about Dadaism.
Dadaism emerges during the First World War in Europe. First World War is very miserable. It's a stupid war. Didn't need to happen. Just domino effect results in this enormous conflict. And people are just sick of what that says about the world. And Dadaism comes out of it. It's all really flamboyant. It's all really, it's bonkers. I mean, I was watching a video, it's from 1917. This guy called Hugo Ball, who is, one of the founders of Dadaism, a club in Switzerland called Cabaret Voltaire. It's also the name of a sort of publication because it's kind of a satirical club. And I was watching this video and it's him dressed in what looks like a giant toothpaste tube, just shouting gibberish. And then he gets dragged off.
Holaka
That tells you all you need to know about Dadaism. Deliberately provocative, deliberately confusing. Perhaps the most famous Dadaist work is Marcel Duchamp's Fountain, you know, which is just a urinal with...
I didn't know that was how you pronounced that word.
Oh, urinal. Yeah, we do say urinal. Yeah.
Urinal.
Yeah, no, I don't know. It's weird. It is weird.
Do you say urinary?
Urinary. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know that that's not how language works. You know.
Yeah.
You know, emphases shift depending on what comes after it. No one says urine anymore. Everyone says urine now.
Uh-huh.
But I swear, growing up, I'm nostalgic for when people used to pronounce it urine, but no one does anymore. But we do still say urinal.
Nostalgic for the earlier pronunciation of pee.
Those were the days. Panda pop, cheap panda pop, and urine. Shut up, Robert.
This conversation has.
This is supposed to be about
avant-garde.
Yes. I'm so hot anyway. This is not fair.
It was an avant-garde twist into Dadaism and the absurdity of it, right?
And he saw, and actually, the name written on it is Mutt.
Mutt.
Mm-hmm. But I'm pronouncing it like that because the German word for poverty is Armut.
Oh, I see.
Which I think it's a very...
It's a pun.
It's a pun. There's a lot of German stuff going on. Like Hugo Ball, who I mentioned earlier, spelt Hugo Ball. Looks like he could be an Englishman, but he's not. He's a German. And yeah, this is going on in Switzerland.
Duchamp also had a female alter ego, right?
I didn't know that.
Rose c'est la vie, which is a pun on the phrase Eros c'est la vie, which is sex is life.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's like sort of drag culture, isn't it? Basically. Punning names for your female alter ego. But Dadaism, the name of it isn't, we're not 100% sure.
Yeah, there are like three or four theories about it.
Could just be that it's a childish noise for something that's deliberately sort of quite reductive. Yeah, I think it's probably better to call it that. And then there's this story that Hugo Ball and a guy called Richard Hulzebeck, so Ricard, perhaps. Sorry, I don't know. One day they're just they're coming up with a name, so they flick through a French dictionary and it falls open at the head word Dada, which just happens to be the French word for a hobby horse, but it doesn't really matter that that's what it is. They just like the syllables, so they call it Dadaism.
It is entwined a bit with surrealism, though surrealism is quite a bit older, right? And here was my favorite revelation from researching this episode, that the adjective surreal, which means, you know, dreamlike or bizarre or strangely unreal, did not give us the name of the movement. Surreal is a back formation of surrealism. So surrealism and surrealist were coined in around 1917, and then we didn't get surreal as an adjective until the 1930s.
So if you describe something as surreal, you're saying that it is like it is something created by a surrealist.
Yes, exactly.
Not that a surrealist is creating surreal things. So where does surrealism come from then?
Realism was around the 18th century. So this overlaps with some of the movements that we've talked about. It was a rejection of the idealization of like romanticism in favor of more ordinary life. And it's not just visual arts too. Realism is also in literature and such too. And the réalisme movement in France was followed some of the revolutions, and it talked about like the growing interest in social conditions and political change and ordinary people. And then 70 some odd years later, surrealism was coined by Guillaume Apollinaire, who talked about the idea of this movement that was beyond realism. And that's where we got things like art that defies conventional logic and reason and and sort of mocks the like failure of social institutions through absurdity.
So it's the French preposition sur, mm-hmm, for on top of. So it's like, yes, on top of reality.
But it's above or beyond in this context. Super realism.
I wanted to talk about the fact that we have artistic techniques that have fancy French names, but the things they mean in French are really lame. like collage, mm-hmm. which just means gluing.
Yes.
Papier-mâché, which just means chewed paper, literally chewed paper. Découpage, which just means cutouts. And actually a more interesting one, though, is silhouette. It's only interesting because we don't know where the word comes from, but we do know who.
Yes.
It's named after. It's kind of I don't know why it is named after Étienne de Silhouette, who is a French politician. He served as Contrôleur Général, or something like that, in the 1700s. Known for being sort of frugal and imposing quite sort of petty austerity on the people, so making sort of savings here and there. And one of the theories behind silhouette is that what is a silhouette? Okay, it's a painting of someone from the side, and it's just black. So very low on detail, very cheap. It's done by cutting out a piece of black paper traditionally. So I think the idea is that it's kind of low rent, therefore worthy of such a frugal, penny-pinching official. But that's only one of the theories. Another one is that it's somehow a reference to his brief term in office. I don't really understand how that is. It's as if like you don't have an opportunity to get a full impression of him. I don't know. But the more simple explanation is that apparently he likes to make silhouettes.
That himself. Seems...
He didn't call them that, obviously.
The most practical explanation.
I get to cut out of me. It does, doesn't it? Yeah, exactly. It might be that. It seems like it should be really easy to solve that. Just ask, well, not ask someone, obviously, it was in the 1750s.
But it's like not that long ago. We wrote about these things.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. But authoritative sources do not come down in one of those three camps necessarily. So it might be just that he liked making silhouettes. But it's just one of those words that you wouldn't necessarily think is named after a person.
It reminds me of the history of the miniature, if I may.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, please do.
Okay, so the word mini, you would think, is probably short for miniature, right? Like a mini camera or a mini skirt is typically a miniature camera or a miniature skirt.
I would definitely take that as a fact, 100% true. It must be.
But miniature isn't related to words that mean small at all. So not minuscule, not minimum, not minus, not minor. Those are all from the same Latin root, which means small and has to do with minimization.
And also miniatures. So I pronounce it in the three-syllable way rather than the four-syllable way. Yeah, yeah, it's weird.
I think it's probably just lazy Americanism that makes it miniature.
No, I don't think it is. I think you, if you look through, you can see spellings that suggest the three syllables, but it's really weird to have three unstressed syllables in an English word. That's really odd to go stressed, then three unstressed syllables. So that might be why it gets shortened to miniature, mm-hmm. Just to make it a bit more sort of Anglo-friendly. But they are small. Miniatures are small things,
yes. Mm-hmm.
Obviously. So that's why I would have assumed that it was related to mini.
Right. But miniature is from the Latin word miniare, which means to paint red. And it's from minium, which was the name of a lead-based red paint used to illuminate medieval manuscripts. If you look at a medieval manuscript, you'll see a sort of red-orange color everywhere. And it is because it was painted with minium. And a miniature was originally a word for one of those manuscript illuminations, especially, but not exclusively, one pigmented with minium. You also see it, like, if you look at diacriticals and early paragraph marks, pilcrows, they're usually painted in that sort of orange-red ink / paint. It evolved because the paintings in illuminated manuscripts were small compared to things like frescoes and larger paintings. And although it's still in use today, a broader range of available pigments kind of reduced the reliance on minium in illuminations over time. So by influence of our friend folk etymology, the reduced synonymousness between minium and illustrations combined with the structure of words like minimum and minuscule shifted the definition and the assumed origin of miniature to today's meaning.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
And one of the reasons that Silhouette reminded me of this is that one critical stepping stone that sort of solidified the modern definition and made it mean a small thing was the portrait miniature, which was a portrait style from the 16th century that drew on similar techniques as manuscript miniatures, but didn't make use of minium. And they were small in size, so you could give one to the person you loved or to a family member or something like that.
And these were like the misleading Tinder profile of their day as well.
Right? Yes.
I forget which of Henry VIII's wives he married based upon her miniature and was very upset when she turned up.
a cheap way to produce a miniature like this was to do it in silhouette, right? So then that was the logical association anyway.
Yeah, actually, when I think of silhouettes, I do think of them as kind of being like miniatures. Miniatures. So you genuinely do miniature and I do miniature.
Miniature. It's a gamble. Whatever's going to come miniature out of my mouth.
that's the philosophy of this podcast, Jess. You never know what the hell's going to come out of her mouth.
This isn't that revelatory, but I do think it's interesting. And I hadn't fully thought through it until I looked this up a few years ago, honestly. But a portrait is a portrait, a portrayal.
Yes, I wanted to mention this when I did landscape, because it's the same idea, right? Whenever we use the word landscape, we're invoking the idea of the painting. It's the same with portrait. It refers to a type of painting first. But yes, it comes from exactly the same sources, the word portrayal and portray.
We think of a portrait as being an image of a person, or I suppose it could be an animal or something, but nothing about the word has anything to do with that as a particular subject. It literally means to draw forth or to trace out, or like to pull or drag. It's related to any word with like the Latin trahere in it.
One thing that I was looking up was Leonardo da Vinci's Mona Lisa. It's like, what does the Mona bit actually mean at the start of there? And it is just sort of a contraction of Madonna, right? It just mean my lady Lisa. But the weird thing is we know it by that name, which is not an English name, but that is only like the English name for that painting. It's in Italian, it's called La Gioconda, which means the happy one, but is a pun on the name of Lisa herself, because her name was Lisa del Giocondo. That is a much smaller painting than you expect it to be.
We've been talking about fine art so far. I would like to take us to perhaps a more fundamental artistic tool, the crayon, that is a perfect medium for fine art. I'm not there to decide what is and isn't. I am no art critic, but modern crayons are usually made from like wax and pigment. But the same word was also used for chalk-based drawing sticks and other coloring sticks made of charcoal and oil and other binders. And it's a very old word. The French crayon originally meant chalk pencil, and it's from a Latin root meaning chalk. The Latin word crita is kind of unknown as far as its root sense. It meant chalk or pipe clay, but it could mean something like earth from Crete, or it could be a Celtic word for mud or clay. Probably just means clay.
Hence the word Cretaceous, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it could be either related to Crete as a place name, or it could be from the name of Crete because of its chalk or mud or clay.
Yeah, you get this. This is the same problem with the word copper, isn't it? Is it from Cyprus, or is Cyprus named after copper?
Right.
We don't know, because the Romans got their copper from Cyprus, but which we don't know which happened first.
Same issue with Cyprus trees, whole thing.
Oh, really? Yeah, there we go.
Mm-hmm,
But crayon is just the French for pencil now.
The medium that is now a crayon is sort of the grandchild of encaustic painting, which is made of pigment with heated beeswax. And that's used in ancient Greece and ancient Egypt and Rome, things like that. Anyway, in 1903, if we fast forward from the ancients, Alice Stead Binney coined the name Crayola, which of course crayons are named after the French crayon, but from the French clay meaning chalk with the part of the word oleaginous, which means oily. And that's for the paraffin wax used in the crayons. But what I wanted to talk about in particular was the names of a few collector crayon colors, which are rare crayons that are hard to find and people will collect because although perhaps the color still exists and is in the box, the paper on it says something different than it does now.
Ooh, okay. Collectible crayons, go.
The rarest and supposedly most sought after Crayola crayon is Torch Red. It was produced very briefly from 1997 to 1998 before being renamed to Scarlet. So finding an authentic vintage wrapper bearing the name Torch Red became a big collector's item. The crayon was named in honor of Gary K. Woodring, who is a gold medal winning Paralympian and wheelchair athlete who became the chief of prosthetics for the U.S. Veterans Administration Medical Center in Philadelphia. And it was one of his clients who won the chance to name a crayon color in a contest. And he chose to name it after Gary, in the sense that he was a Paralympian. The torch in that case is an Olympic torch.
Olympic torch. Uh-huh. Oh, there we go.
Another one, which you do actually see these around because there were enough of them for a while that collectors have several of them, is Dandelion, which was this bright yellow-orange shade that was officially retired in 2017 and sparked a big collecting frenzy when it happened because at this point we had caught on to the fact that they were collector's items. But anyway, although a lot of other colors had been retired before, it was the first one to be removed from the box set in the 114 years since Crayola was established. Oh, wow. It did this because it wanted to add a blue crayon, which is now called Blutiful, and was inspired.
Oh, I hate that. Don't replace Dandelion with Blutiful.
I like the color Dandelion better too. It looks nicer, even though I like blues better than yellows generally. Anyway, it was inspired by a newly discovered pigment called Yinmen Blue, and they wanted to introduce that to the 24-pack. So it touched off this big collecting frenzy, like I said. Although it was dropped from Crayola's range in 2017, like I said, it was reintroduced in 2025 as a limited edition in the 64-count Crayola packs.
Big business using specific shades. I mean, you know, there are brands who rely on it, obviously Tiffany, Cadbury as well, who've all got trademarks, I think, on specific colors.
I'm reminded of Meryl Streep's cerulean speech in Devil Wears Prada. The main character, played by Anne Hathaway, is sort of like snorts when she's in the like Vogue back rooms because they're talking about, they're trying to pair, I forget what they have. It's like one clothing item with another and she thinks they look exactly the same, and then she gets lectured by Miranda Priestly and she gives her a whole speech about like what you do not know is that the lumpy sweater you're wearing comes from a whole line of fashion designers and it was introduced on the runway in this year, and it's a great speech, it's fun. But yeah, color is a big thing, and it has been since for all time, right? I mean, some of the earliest things that were traded as symbols of wealth were pigments, right?
Yeah, like porphyro, which gives us the word purple. Mm-hmm. The color of regal robes before we decided that red was a bit more regal.
Blues, purples, reds, anything really vivid, right?
Yeah, very true. Very true. Big business.
I have two more crayon colors.
Have you got burnt umber?
No, but I do have flesh.
Ah.
So it was originally called Flesh Tint from 1903 to 1949.
That's a horrible collection of syllables, flesh tint. It's terrible.
Yes, and you can imagine what color flesh tint was. Yes. It was definitely white people flesh tint.
Oh, it was skin color, was it? Oh,
yeah. No, it wasn't. Yeah, no. It wasn't bloody and red.
Yeah, honestly, what I was thinking.
They should have called it epidermis. Anyway,
beautiful.
White people epidermis. Yeah. Anyway, it was
Caucasian
called. It was
male.
Anyway, it was just shortened to flesh from 19.
Where are we? Sorry, it was just shortened to flesh. Go on.
It was just shortened to flesh in 1949 till 1956. And then it was briefly pink beige for 2 years. And then it went back to flesh until 1962. And then in 1962, it was renamed to peach. And now it is still peach. It was the light orange color in the 24 crayon box until the mid-1990s when apricot took its place. And it's currently in all of the larger boxes. So that's the story of flesh in your crayon box.
I remember peach. I remember the peach crayon from my childhood. That's a very vivid memory. Great. Jess, I'm so hot, I think I get to expire.
Okay.
Can we bring it to an end?
I have it's like one sentence, the last crayon color. I said I had two, so one more.
Oh, you did. Sorry, I thought you'd covered it.
Last one, very briefly. There was an early color beginning in 1949 that was named Prussian Blue, and it was renamed Midnight Blue in 1958 because Prussia wasn't exactly relevant anymore.
Yeah, fair point. I'm speaking to you from Prussia, technically.
Yeah, there you are.
Well, I'm not even Caucasian male colored anymore. I am closer to torch red. What was it? Something, what was it? Flesh taint.
Flesh tint.
Oh, flesh tint. can I do one last? Well, it won't be the last one. I bet I'll try to squeeze again. Plug for my Edinburgh show. If anyone's going to be in Edinburgh between the 6th and the 16th of August, please come and see me. I'm doing a wordy, nerdy hour.
Several times, right?
Yeah, doing it 10 nights in a row.
Yeah,
so you've got plenty of chance to get me.
Excellent.
Anything to plug, Jess?
I have a book called A Miscellany of Weird and Wonderful Facts for Curious Humans Who Have Nothing Better to Do Than Read. You know who you are. I didn't come up with that title, but I did enjoy it. The publisher was like, would you like to write this book? And I was like, with that title? Yeah, sure. But I co-authored it with my friend Shannon Miller, who's a pop culture reporter. So you'll see a bunch of language facts in there, and I probably wrote those. And if there are pop culture facts, she probably wrote those. But it was fun and collaborative, and we had a few other people contribute. So check it out.
I'm looking forward to getting hold of a copy soon as boss. Thank you very much, Jess. Enjoyed this.
Yes. All right. We'll see you next time on Words Unraveled.
Cheerio.